This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In all my career, I've never had a situation where we were receiving over 8,000 refugees a day and international media had not picked up on it. This is something that has surprised us all. So no international attention, no additional funds. I mean, and that's what happens.
That's Jess Kamstra of the Lutheran World Federation talking about 40,000 South Sudanese refugees waiting for help at the Ugandan border. Details coming up also. UN warns hatred against the ethnic Tutsi minority in Burundi could develop into genocide. And today is World Elephant Day. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, an unprecedented number of refugees from South Sudan have been streaming into Uganda since fighting broke out in Juba last month. In some border towns, refugees now outnumber local residents. Humanitarian agencies working at the border say more assistance is urgently needed. Elizabeth Polat has the story from Kampala.
In the past month, around 70,000 South Sudanese have sought refuge in Uganda. Many arrived malnourished and in desperate need of medical care. Aid agencies have swung into emergency mode, trying to provide clean water, food, sanitation, and shelter at overcrowded refugee intake centers. Catherine Entebade with the UN Children's Fund said they've had to expand quickly to keep possible disease outbreaks at bay.
I mean, having 4,000 people, even just 1,000 people in one place, so you're looking at challenges of hygiene, water. We've been able to construct temporary bathing shelters for people to use, temporary latrines. These are at 10. We've also installed a water treatment system to help ease on the access of safe water. The critical thing that we are enforcing is to sensitize this population about good hygiene.
Budget shortfalls, however, could hinder this work. According to the Norwegian Refugee Council, aid agencies have only received 20% of the funds they need to adequately handle the current flow of refugees. And with tensions still high in Juba, many refugees have no imminent plans to return home. Jesse Kamstra works with the Lutheran World Federation.
Currently, we have approximately 40,000 refugees that are in holding centers waiting to be moved. And those had to be constructed on an ad hoc basis. In all my career, I've never had a situation where we were receiving over 8,000 refugees a day and international media had not picked up on it. This is something that has surprised us all. So no international attention, no additional funds. I mean, and that's what happens.
Uganda hosts just over 500,000 refugees, mostly from the DRC and South Sudan. Although aid agencies praise the Ugandan government's welcoming approach, in some areas like Adjumani District, South Sudanese now outnumber Ugandan citizens. This has caused a rise in community tension. One local resident told VOA by phone that vegetation is being cleared to settle refugees, and that is impacting local cattle herders. The government has opened a new settlement camp that can house 100,000 refugees in a bid to ease the burden in Adjumani. Yet without adequate funds, the new camp does not have the infrastructure it needs and clean water access. Aid agencies say emergency operations are far from over. The NRC says 80,000 more refugees from South Sudan are expected to arrive by year's end. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
As South Sudan continues to reel from conflict, the regional bloc IGAD, the African Union, and the United Nations are trying to find a solution. That may include a proposal to send a regional protection force to complement the UN mission in South Sudan. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig speaks with analysts about whether or not they believe South Sudan's August 2015 peace agreement is dead.
Following 20 months of violence in South Sudan, a peace agreement was signed in August 2015 that was intended to stop fighting between the rival forces of President Salva Kiir and his former first vice president Riek Machar's SPLM-IO. But disagreements continued, and new violence engulfed Juba in July, although a tenuous ceasefire is holding in the capital city. Within this environment of instability, many are wondering whether the peace agreement is even relevant at this point. SPLM-IO acting representative to Kenya, Lam Juak, says Kiir's forces are still targeting Riek Machar, a major reason why he believes the peace agreement is on shaky footing.
Peace agreement is in coma. He's in ICU.
A request for a response from Kiir's spokesman went unanswered. Retired Sudanese ambassador and UN official Noureldine Sati expresses hope South Sudan can still pick up the pieces and the August 2015 peace agreement can be salvaged.
But of course, patients do not stay for too long in an ICU. They have to come out of it sooner than later. Preferably not to the graveyard, of course, to come back to normal life.
But Steve McDonald, global fellow at the Washington-based Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, is skeptical the 2015 peace deal will ever know a normal life, given the July outbreak of violence in Juba and Machar's subsequent departure.
Even though international players, including the regional players, IGAD and the AU, are trying to pull things back together again, I have very little hope that the peace agreement between Machar and Kiir can ever work.
Sati says the security situation must be stabilized in South Sudan before meaningful progress can take place. And in the interest of the country and its long-term prospects, he says Kiir and Machar must reconcile their differences.
But as I always say, security measures alone are not enough. We have to find political solutions to problems, as we all know.
Horn of Africa research associate at London-based Chatham House, Ahmed Soliman, urges South Sudan's economy also be prioritized because it affects security and political issues. He references the more than 600% inflation rate in the country during the past year.
You've seen people, civil servants and others, not being paid for many months, growing costs of water and fuel, and even within the protection of civilian sites, people struggling very much to be able to feed themselves, and a lack of payment for the armed forces has contributed to unrest and kind of escalating criminality in Juba and elsewhere.
And with respect to the people with guns, former British ambassador to Sudan, Alan Goltie, says a solution will likely not be found until they acknowledge a better way forward.
And at the moment, there's no alternative. If you put down your gun, where are you going to find employment or income or a way of sustaining your family?
The country now waits to learn whether the UN Security Council will adopt a resolution circulated by the United States, authorizing 4,000 peacekeepers for Juba. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Two new cases of polio have been discovered in areas of Nigeria once held by Boko Haram fighters. The Islamist extremists frequently attacked the polio vaccinators during years of rebel occupation. Health officials from the Nigerian government and the World Health Organization yesterday have confirmed the two cases of polio. Nigerian Health Minister Isaac Adewole says officials discovered two children paralyzed by polio in northeastern Borno state. Borno is one of the three states cut off from the rest of the world by Boko Haram's Islamic extremist uprising. Adewole says he has ordered deployment of National Emergency Response Team to begin large-scale immunizations and other measures. Less than a year ago, officials declared Nigeria had been removed from the list of polio-endemic countries. That October announcement also meant the entire African continent was free of the crippling disease. Burundi youth are at risk of being trafficked to Asian countries as a result of high unemployment in the nation. A Burundi Association Against Human Trafficking says the number to leave Zimbabwe for work could increase drastically if no emergency measures are taken. Moses Javier Amana reports.
As Burundi is now steadily gaining stability after more than a year of political crisis, youth in Burundi have been affected by the crisis, as many played roles in protests, with others fleeing the country. Critics say nation's younger population feels hopeless with no job prospects here at home. They say many are ending up in hands of human traffickers in search for job opportunities. Abdi is a car mechanic in Buyenzi.
Burundi naona kwa sasa kazi ni ndogo sana, ujira umekuwa mdogo.
Abdi says now currently in Burundi there are less job opportunities, and that since last year all businesses were affected by the political instability. He says even though some youth engage themselves in doing mechanics like him, he says he can spend the whole day without getting a client. The Burundi Investment Promotion Authority recorded 43% increase in investment in the country since the beginning of the year, but youth unemployment remains high, especially among university graduates. Gilbert Ndayishimiye is still a student at the university in Burundi.
In a country where the private sector is not developed, you can't expect a country to develop. You can't expect people to find a job because the government can't provide a job for most of the young people. And it's very, very difficult to understand how young people go away to find jobs, and especially they are, it's as a human trafficking, because they go there thinking that they are going to find a job, but sometimes they realize once they are there that it's not a job they are looking for. I think unemployment is a serious issue.
Burundi police have arrested 7 people suspected of human trafficking, sending Burundian youth to Asian countries. The government says more than 267 girls were trafficked in the last 3 months, and a Burundi Bar Association official fears that the number could double as more youth are still leaving the country. Prim Barubukeye is the chairman of the association. Prim says there are some families that have come for help in order to find their children or siblings that have fell in human trafficking, so as to help them return to the country, as many have reported of abuses and some have been sexually abused. He says it is really a worrying situation because that the number is continuing to increase instead of decreasing. He says recently some Burundians were stopped by the Rwandan authority as they were being taken to Kenya, from where they could board their flights. Prim calls on the Burundi government to take necessary measures to cut the chain of human trafficking that has continued to strive in the country. I met a brother of a victim of human trafficking who came to the Bar Association for help. He declined to give his name because of security reasons. He says some local leaders came to them looking for young girls to find for them better jobs outside the country, and especially those who are educated. He says that's when her sister got interested, since she thought she'll get a better job. He says, after being advised by some friends, his sister changed her mind and decided not to go. But the local administrators threatened the family to pay $2,000 that was spent to get her travel documents, and they had no any other option but to let her go since they couldn't raise the money. The Burundi 2015 fiscal policy had focused on effective implementation of the strategic framework for growth and fight against poverty. The sectorial consultations on youth employment were designed to integrate the major priorities of youth to reduce the large unemployment rate in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Jobs for youth is also a concern in Zimbabwe, where UNICEF has released a report concluding this Southern African nation needs about $45 million to address the healthcare and employment needs of the country's youth. Sebastian Mumfu has more from Harare.
If President Robert Mugabe's government does not take action, Zimbabwe would experience a population boom, while crime rate would increase by about 12% in the next 10 years as unemployed youths embark on vices that include robbery and unprotected sex, according to the report released Thursday. In an interview, UNICEF Zimbabwe head of social policy and research, Samson Muradzikwa, said time is running out.
The youth need our help, and to do that, we need to invest wisely and now. So figures of about 44 million or so between now and 2025 to address critical gaps is important for us. We are losing every day from all these young people lying idle. We are estimating that the country is losing about 1.5 to 2 billion each year because of youth idleness and youth underemployment.
More than three quarters of Zimbabwe's population of about 13 million are young people. The under 35s have been the majority of the protesters in the current wave of demonstrations that have rocked President Mugabe's government. Zimbabwe Youth Minister Patrick Joao said the figure of $44.7 million needed to address the problems of health care and unemployment would be difficult to secure locally. But he is optimistic the issues raised by the report would be attended to.
It is very feasible because obviously within any particular investment space, you've got limited resources. So given whatever level of resources we have as a nation, we are now able to make sure that those resources are applied in as effective, in as efficient, and in as economical a manner as possible on the basis of this report.
Besides basic health care and employment needs, issues the report said needed attention were early marriages, unintended pregnancies, high school dropouts, especially for girls, high risks of contracting HIV and marginalization in the mainstream economic activities as a result of resource mismanagement and corruption. Zimbabwe's social sector, once an envy of many developing countries, has during the past 15 years been mainly left for the Western donors to support. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Today is World Elephant Day, and conservationists around the world are using the opportunity to spread awareness about the violent and critical threats elephants are facing. They are also hoping to garner support for positive solutions to ensure their survival. The international conservation group, the Nature Conservancy, is one organization that has been working to preserve these large creatures by teaming up with partners around the world to increase security for elephants, conserve habitat, reduce the demand for ivory, and most importantly, engage local communities. Matthew Brown is the Africa Region Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the dwindling elephant population in Africa and what they are doing about it.
Today we believe the population of elephants is about 430,000 individuals on the continent. In the early 80s, we think there was about 1.2 million elephants. So it's quite a dramatic decrease. And the last 3 to 5 years, we've seen about 25,000 elephants a year being killed, mainly driven by poaching. Pretty significant impact on the population of elephants.
How have your anti-poaching efforts worked so far?
Well, I think the anti-poaching efforts that the Nature Conservancy and all the conservation organizations and local NGOs and governments do has a huge impact. Where there is good frontline protection, it definitely helps. You know, the poachers are weighing a risk-reward scenario, and so where there's more protection, the risk is higher, of getting caught or fired or shot at, Where there's better protection, we're seeing less elephants being poached. Now, that doesn't always mean that if you've got good protection, you're completely safe, because obviously with the price being as high as it is right now, it's about $2,000 a kilogram for ivory. So the elephants are of high value. And so even with frontline protection, we're seeing incidents happen. But generally, the poaching happens in areas that are less well protected than in other areas.
When you're speaking of frontline protection, what exactly is that for elephants?
So it's armed rangers. It's both community scouts. Sometimes the community scouts aren't even armed. You know, here in Tanzania, they're Maasai who have a cell phone and a bicycle, and they're actually paid by a conservation organization to be out in the area where there are elephants and to basically be informants and just make calls. And then the government comes in with police and they make the arrest. Other times it's government rangers working in the national parks who are heavily armed and very well trained. And then there's often a cadre of these private conservancies or even community conservancies who have sort of their own private force of rangers that are out there doing the patrolling. So there's a whole spectrum there of degree of arming and degree of experience and training. The key thing is to communicate. In almost all these countries, it's the job of the police in the country and often the wildlife department or the wildlife division to actually help with the arrest. And then it moves through a police process into the judicial systems for prosecution.
Can you give some examples of how the community is being educated on conservation?
For example, there are communities who have ecotourism lodges either in their community lands or just adjacent, maybe on a conservancy. But those lodges hire cooks and guides and staff from the communities. And so those jobs are just paramount. That's a huge benefit. That's the number one benefit that communities cite from wildlife. There are other benefits like schools and fresh water and adult education programs, even clinics. So there's a lot of services that these conservancies and that wildlife dollars help support. And so the idea here is to change the paradigm where local communities see that elephant worth more alive than dead.
When you're looking at overall the future of elephants, and let's just look at the African continent, what does the future hold for elephants? For example, what would Africa be like without elephants?
Well, that's a terrible thought, especially today on World Elephant Day, where we're trying to raise awareness to keep elephants alive. The vision of a landscape, let's say, without elephants is one where the elephants provide better habitat and I think better security for many other species of wildlife. They provide better habitat because they help keep back a lot of the invasive woody vegetation, a lot of the bushes and shrubs, for example. They also are critical seed dispersers for some of the plants and trees. So elephants have evolved as part of all these landscapes, and therefore they are a critical piece of that food web. And also elephants, because they live to be 70 years and they have these great memories, they are able to keep movement corridors open and they're able to go back and find water sources that maybe hadn't been used for 20 years. So in a long drought, they can actually lead other species to where there's good water and they can lead their young even more importantly. So some of the older elephants, some of the matriarchs, the mothers are really critical. You know, in Africa without elephants, it's really hard to envision from where I sit. I actually think that the big threat to elephants in the near term is poaching, but the bigger threat to elephants in the longer term is habitat loss. As human population grows, as the climate changes and puts more vegetation stress on the landscape, and as home ranges shift as a result of that, the blockages, the development from agriculture and fences and housing that we see across elephants' home range in Africa is a real critical threat. All these conservation efforts are trying to do in the long term is to make sure there's good, viable habitat for elephants. That's what we sort of call the beyond poaching issue. Once we get through this poaching crisis, which hopefully we will in the next few years, the bigger issue is the habitat.
Matthew Brown is the African Region Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Arusha, Tanzania. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.